Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never. And, you know, we ended probably yesterday's episode. Probably it's one of my favorite endings because everybody was, you know, clinging, or at least I know Paul was, when he goes, "What? The state's hoodwinked?"
You will see, GR, I was aghast because I had thought originally that Marshall was the purveyor of this idea that we're getting to, and now you're telling me that he was hoodwinked by the states, and that just threw me for a loop. I'm anxiously awaiting, and I imagine the audience is too, what you mean by that.
Okay, so the Constitution basically gave the authority to the court to hear cases and make rulings. Is there any latitude in the Constitution whatsoever for the court to make opinions?
Well, what is the difference between a ruling and an opinion?
So a ruling is the technical finding that you cannot tax. In Maryland v. McCullough, the state cannot tax. The opinion basically kind of creates the reasoning behind why we ruled that way. And that's where all of a sudden a judge can cross the line and start basically playing with the law and actually creating legislation. The opinions are very, Madison never once argued that Marshall was wrong regarding some of his, you know, arguments or some of his decisions. I don't think he was happy with Maryland v. McCullough because, not Maryland v. McCullough, Marbury v. Madison, just due to the fact that he broke jurisdiction. He should not, the ruling and, you know, the opinion should have just been thrown out completely.
So
he had no jurisdiction. Therefore, shut up, close your doors, go home, wait till a case shows up so that you can do your job.
So why didn't Madison, you know, I mean, he was present, right? Why didn't he just smack him around?
Well, so in the very beginning, there was no thing called case law, constitutional precedents, or anything like that. The court couldn't do anything like that. The court basically ruled on case by case by case. There was no such thing as case law or constitutional law.
Okay.
And what ended up happening is after the framers died, because they didn't nip this in the bud immediately, they all hoodwinked it. So when I say the states hoodwinked it, the state should have stepped up and said, hey, hold on here. This judge made a ruling. We contend that we're okay with the ruling. We may not like it, but we're okay because that is the ultimate end of the case. But this opinion, we have a problem with, because this opinion can actually start stretching and bending the law in a direction that we don't agree with. And down the road, when all of a sudden these opinions were used to actually settle cases, well, Marshall said that the federal government was supreme in all things that it determined necessary and proper. They started combining these clauses out of context.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is how they were able to unconstitutionally usurp stuff. By using this case law and precedents to say, well, if he said that, then surely we should be able to do these things.
Right.
You see how the states hoodwinked it by allowing it to move forward piece by piece, gradually, to where Marshall was instrumental in these seven hallmark cases that we've identified, or maybe eight, but there are these clear hallmark cases that laid the groundwork to where people in future years could point to his opinions and say, well, he said this, therefore it's law.
So what has power? It's the ruling, not the opinion.
Correct. The ruling is, you know, so when they ruled on something they had no jurisdiction, the state should have stepped in and said, hold it. Why did you even hear this case? How does this arise under this Constitution? Can you please prove you have jurisdiction or standing?
Right.
It doesn't fall under you. It does not arise under this Constitution. And, you know, when they started using these ambiguities like this right to privacy, no, that, you know, the state should have constantly said, look, if you want to amend the Constitution, then give us an amendment to start bringing privacy and those types of things in. But bottom line, a person has a right to, you know, to privacy, or actually, what does it say? You're secure in your person and in your effects, in your home and in your effects. So right. In other words, as you travel around, whatever you carry, you're secure. But if you go into a health clinic to actually abort a child, then that's a crime. And that was a crime in the state where that case happened. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court ruled that it wasn't a crime based on the fact that nobody should have known she had a right in her privacy to be able to do what she wanted to in, you know, that particular case. Well, hold on here. If you know a woman's pregnant, she goes into the clinic and she comes back and she's no longer pregnant. What happened?
And she doesn't have the baby in her arms, right?
Correct. So what happened? You know, there is this, you know, government's primary objective is to protect life and to protect property. And what they ended up doing with Blackmun, a Nixon appointee to the court, Blackmun was the main one that made the ruling. They basically said a woman has a right to go do whatever she wants to do behind a closed door and obtain a treatment with whatever she wants. Okay, well, at what cost?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is where it came down to, you know, in the state that this happened, they said that this is, you know, this was a violation of the law because it was clearly a violation of the law. It was a state law. Well, the federal government has no jurisdiction over that state law. There was no constitutional rights being violated. As a matter of fact, the federal government, having the same obligation of protecting life and property, should have basically said, you know, we see nothing here that we have jurisdiction over. And this is a life and property issue that clearly falls under the state laws, not a right, and it does not arise under our Constitution.
Correct.
So what ended up happening, and this is why, you know, all of these lawyers and judges do everything they can to drag a case across a federal line. Because as soon as they can get it there, then that's when they can bend the law. And everybody believes that the federal court is supreme. Oh, well, because they said so. Come on now, folks. It is very clear. They're only supreme over those things. This is why we're going to end up having a petition, folks, that will actually call out the court for any of their rulings and any of these decisions that they've created. It's one thing for a decision that actually fell under their cognizance. But when we look at things like Title IX, you know, where in the heck do they have the authority to create all of these different titles? Where did they get this cognizance? Where did they get how are these things arising under the Constitution, like women's athletics at colleges or, you know, steroids in baseball? Come on. Right. There is nothing under the sun that they will not usurp, when clearly the Constitution limits them to very minute, specific roles, responsibilities, powers, and property. That's it. If it doesn't have anything to do with that, it should never be in their court. Now, I don't mean to say they can't have water cooler conversations, but
right.
But clearly, they can't be articulating what is law over things that they have no jurisdiction over.
Right.
And this is why I emphasize this. And, you know, it just, I know people use it as a point to try to poke me in the eye. And as a matter of fact, I heard this came from Political Theatrics. And I hear this from these idiots to go, hey, GR, what cases have you won in court over what you're doing? And I go, you realize how stupid you just sounded?
Mm-hmm.
Because bottom line, the court has no jurisdiction over these things. The ultimate court are the states. This is where the states actually have to pull together and create that what Madison calls the tribunal of where the right. states actually come together and they start making the decisions because they become the judge and the jury. They form this court and they become the magistrate over the Constitution because as collectively, they have that power to hold full accountability. This is why the Convention of States is the biggest bamboozling of America to think that we're, you know, so many hours of debate in state houses and petitions moving forward into Congress to say we, you know, however many states have done this. This is absolutely the biggest waste of time. Absolutely the biggest waste of time. And it just infuriates me. Because mm-hmm. people don't understand that the states already possess all the power necessary. They don't need to form a convention to amend the Constitution to get Congress to approve that. The states possess the power inherently to enforce their compact. They are the superior in all things over that compact, especially when it comes to violations of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. I'm getting really animated. You know, this is where I don't keep a gun in the studio, folks, for this purpose. I'm a pretty good shot. I'm telling you. I'm an expert with both hand and long barrel. So anyway, right, rifle, handgun, what have you? Anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so okay. Eating up about 12 minutes of your time, folks, but I think that this is really important. Why, you know, Madison and the states and everybody was just hoodwinking because Marshall was doing this to make himself feel better. Oh, you know, look how smart I am. You know, how I can, you know, articulate this stuff. And this is why I say, I think Marshall was a good man. I think he was just trying to make, you know, he's trying to impress the world what a great judge he was. And actually, that's all backfired. And I truly believe that he's rolling around in his grave going, man, they have completely taken me out of context. And now I'm responsible for all of this unconstitutional overreach. Oh, my goodness. I had no intent in doing that.
Wow.
And that's what happens. That's what happens when you become the devil's advocate.
Wow.
Okay. And it's the same thing with Hamilton. I think that these men were basically good men. They just wanted to push the boundaries, and they had no idea the holes that they were putting in the levee, how the flooding would begin in the later years. Come on.
Well...
Where's the wisdom, right? There's no wisdom.
Well, the flooding is, I mean, we are up to our noses right now. So yeah, that's quite a flood.
Yeah. Well,
so
okay.
So thanks for answering that question.
No problem. We left off with Mr. Davey in this long chain of back and forth, back and forth. This is one of the few debates where I'd really just say, you know what? You can't not pick this stuff up. We got to cover all of this stuff.
Okay.
And so I'm sorry. Forgive me. Folks, no, when you pick up the debates and you read through them, you really do want to read all of them. I'm only highlighting these because they're covering very specific clauses that are pertain to today. But everything else is still just, oh my gosh, it is a treasure. From the beginning to the end, this is a treasure. Just do yourself a favor. highlight the anti-federalist comments so that when you read those, you don't take that out of context like they're speaking out of fact. They're making assertions and insinuations that this Constitution will do these things. This is why you don't actually say, okay, that act actually has some standing. It doesn't. Okay.
Okay. So we are still on the subject of paper money now, and I guess we're picking up with Mr. Davey.
Right? That is correct.
All right.
All right. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, permit me, sir, to make a few observations on the operation of the clause so often mentioned. This Constitution, as to the powers therein granted, is constantly to be the supreme law of the land. Every power ceded by it must be executed without being, without being counteracted by the laws or constitutions of the individual states. Gentlemen should distinguish that it is not the supreme law in the exercise of a power not granted. It can be supreme only in cases consistent with the power specially granted and not in usurpations. If you grant any power to the federal government, the laws made in pursuance of that power must be supreme and uncontrolled in their operation. This consequence is involved in the very nature and necessity of the thing. The only rational inquiry is whether those powers are necessary and whether they are properly granted. To say that you have vested the federal government with power to legislate for the union and then deny the supremacy of the laws is a solecism in terms, a new word. With respect to its operation on our own paper money, I believe that a little consideration will satisfy every man that it cannot have the effect asserted by the gentleman from New Hanover. The Federal Convention knew that several states had large sums of paper money in circulation and that it was an interesting property, and they were sensible that those states would never consent to its immediate destruction or ratify any system that would have that operation. The mischief already done could not be repaired. All that could be done was to form some limitation to this great political evil. As the paper money had become private property and the object of numberless contracts, it could not be destroyed or intermeddled with in that situation, although its baneful tendency was obvious and undeniable. It was, however, affecting an important object to put bounds to this growing mischief. If the states had been compelled to sink the paper money instantly, the remedy might be worse than the disease. As we could not put an immediate end to it, we were content with prohibiting its future increase, looking forward to its entire extinguishment when the states that had an emission circulating should be able to call it in by a gradual redemption. You know, he made a point here that caught my eye. He says, as the paper money had become private property and the object of numberless contracts. So, you know, the states can't impair the execution of a contract, and private property, they're recognizing that private property must still be respected. So they couldn't just snap their fingers, flip a switch, and destroy all that was done.
Okay, so
with their stuff.
How does money in any way become private property?
Well, so what happens is you exchange your labor for something. So your labor has a value, and you get this stuff, even if it's paper, that you've exchanged for value. And so now you expect to be able to exchange that value for something else, right?
Right. So just to be clear, money is what we call currency, right? Okay. Because it is the medium of exchanging this for that.
Right.
Right? So you can pay for goods, you can pay for services, and you use currency. Or you can just barter, I will do these services for those goods.
Okay.
Or I can give you these goods for those goods. Mm-hmm. Regardless, that is the currency of exchange. So okay. How does money become property? When it lands into the hands of an individual, it is now their property. And they can dispose of it any way they want. It is their choice to either utilize, so if you're holding gold, if you're holding silver, and you want to dispose of that as a, you know, as a transaction with somebody to buy a house and say, I'll pay you all of this in gold.
Mm-hmm.
That may be more to that person than actually a higher amount in paper money.
Correct.
Okay. So it all you have to do is do an honest transaction. In other words, an honest transaction is you two sides agree with what the terms of the transaction are, and then they execute the transaction. Mm-hmm. And then that person, there is a transfer of property either in both ways or one way or what have you. It's all based on, you know, if I'm paying you for something, then, you know, I'm paying you for a service. If I pay you in advance and you don't commit the service or you don't actually execute the service, then I should have a right to that property coming back to me.
Correct.
And so because you didn't earn based on that contract of what we agreed upon. So money, as soon as it gets into circulation and into the hands of the people, it becomes property, real property in your hands.
Right.
We do not have property. We lose the essence of property and currency when we go to a digital currency. Because you cannot make the transaction if the government does not agree.
Right.
How now can, because they're already showing this. It says, you know what? You haven't been behaving good. We're not going to give you access to make a transaction.
Right.
They've already been showing how going down this path could actually create this, I'll just say, this terrible evil of a social credit system in America.
Mm-hmm.
Where they control whether you can even commit a transaction. So how much property do you have when we go to a digital currency? And this is just really, it boils my blood to think that not every American isn't standing up and saying, are you kidding me? You cannot do this. And you know what started it all? Where all of these fools that rushed out and just started going, oh, digital, you know, this cryptocurrency, this is great. I'm a millionaire. They caused this problem.
Mm.
They begged for the government to come. So the show me where you can allow digital currency in the United States based on our Constitution. Show me how that could even come to be.
So here's a question. Can people attempt to make a private trade or currency between them?
So
I think a libertarian argument would be, hey, it's, you know, I can choose to trade with anyone who chooses to trade this with me, right?
Yeah, so everybody has the ability to make any transaction that they want with anybody else as long as that other person agrees to the terms of the transaction. But here's the question. Are there some transactions that are considered immoral or unlawful? Can you sell your child?
No.
Okay, but a libertarian view would say, yes, you can.
Would they, before you go in,
right?
You think they'd go that far?
It's the devil's advocate, right? Okay. If you say anything can be sold or trade based on the libertarian view, then the government has no right to limit anything. Whether it's your property, your children, your wife, what have you.
Okay.
All right? I mean, tell me if I'm wrong.
All right.
I'd love to have a libertarian on this show to say, well, yeah, I guess. But if we're a Republican form of government, so we're going into break right now. So hold on, Paul. We'll have to wait till we come back. But let's just put that bee in our bonnet and let it buzz around for the next minute or so until we come back. What are the limits of government? And in a libertarian government, what is it that they're adhering to? What form of government are they trying to live under? Because it doesn't necessarily align with a Republican form of government. We're going to be right back after this.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I always have to tell people, be careful who you advocate when you're becoming the devil's advocate. So Paul, when you really look at, you know, the openness of what a libertarian wants in this government in America, it's not a Republican form of government. It is an anarchical form of government. Does that make sense? Paul, you're probably still on mute, and you're probably...
I got you.
Okay, so...
Yeah, I'm here. In my experience, there seems that way. There seems to be some flavor, some run the range.
Right.
For the most part.
So when a libertarian comes along and says, you know, if I have property, I should be able to sell that property to whomever or to anyone and whatever I want to do with that property. And so, okay, let's... Which means that any person should be able to make any type of transaction they would want as long as that's their property.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a libertarian would come along and basically say, well, you know, obviously another person can't be their property. Well, hold on here.
Sure.
There are paradigms in the world where actually they are. So just because a libertarian doesn't think that way, when you actually open up the law to say government cannot get into the intervention of a transaction between one person and another, now it is no holds barred, because they're going to say, well, I would never do that. You know, you can't do that. Well, hold on. You can't have it both ways. Either transactions are free, you know, it's the wild, wild west, or we have rules and laws. A Republican form of government is one of law.
Right.
And so clearly, everybody can make transactions as long as what the transaction is moral, you know, within their legal power.
Okay.
And within the legal authority of the buyer. Now, if a foreign nation comes along and says, hey, I want to buy that. Well, right now, there is no legitimate law in the United States to allow a foreign nation to be able to buy that. So if you sell to somebody that's willing to buy it, then it is at your own risk, because you could lose that. You may make the money for that, but the government could come in and confiscate that money because you violated the law.
Right. Or, you know, well, not only that, you could lose that, and the foreign entity you sold it to.
Correct. Correct. Now, 9 times out of 10, people usually, once they get their money, they run. Right? So it's hard to get that money back. Once it goes into accounts, they spend it, and next thing you know, they've got a year's supply of bubble gum in a closet that's absolutely worthless to everybody, right? Or whatever. I mean, I'm being, you know, extreme, but the point is that in a Republican form of government, there are laws that dictate whether you can sell to a foreign nation or not, you know, and they can't just challenge the laws of the land. See, when our society, when everybody bought off on this, everybody had a chance at that point in time to head to the hills, to get out of America, go to the nation that you thought would be better. You know, okay. I don't like this type of government. I'm leaving. That's what you do. When I realized in California that the state of California and their laws no longer protected personal property, and this was like in the early 2010 was when I realized this. And I pointed this out to my wife. I said, they're giving illegals, they're starting to make it illegal for you to kick illegals off of your property if all of a sudden they create a cardboard, you know, village, you know, in the corner of your property. Well, then instantly they had this right to your land instead of the state standing up on your legal rights. And instead of being a land of law, it became a land of, you know, I'll just say tyranny, because when it's arbitrary, then it is tyranny. Mm-hmm. So that was when we decided we have to leave the state, because this state government no longer recognizes property rights or individual rights and individual sovereignty. So we left. We happen to be living in a state that is just as bad now.
Right.
And guess what? Regardless of the state we move to, it's going to probably be just as bad. Well, I don't know. There are some dark red states that are getting there. I mean, I'm surprised at where Wyoming is. Because,
how do you mean?
Well, the people that are in the state legislature, I mean, there are some good people in there, but there are some real evil people. They don't even bat an eye with the evil legislation that they're actually putting forward. Here's a great point and a great example. They just had in Gillette this big rally that got a librarian fired, or actually was laid off for 2 years, or fired for 2 years. They cannot work as a librarian in the education system because she refused to remove obscene material. You know, it's child, you know, not child pornography, but erotica, being exposing mm-hmm. children to erotic material, so, or sexually natured. But anyway, so I'm going, hold on here. You got to be kidding me. This woman wasn't arrested? And so I actually posted in their, you know, in this, I'll just say a forum or a page. It was a Wyoming page. I posted the law, the statute, that it is illegal to do this, and this person should be fined and thrown in jail, not laid off.
What kind of response did you get to that?
You know, surprisingly, I only got one person that liked it. Surprisingly. I mean, people just want their vengeance. If you haven't listened to my shows regarding what people really want out of politics, they just want their vengeance. Bottom line, nobody wants to enforce the law. You know, if we don't restore the law of the land and start living by the supreme law and, you know, these constitutions, and this is why in all of my posts, I try to point out that we're doing things that the law doesn't permit. As a matter of fact, I'll bring this up because on the last weekend, I CC'd you, or actually I tagged you on that post that I put to this East Idaho conservative where Trent made the, I forget his last name, but his first name's Trent. And he was complaining about the party, you know, recording these religious meetings or what have you. And I really didn't care about that. The point is, because I poked this guy before, because he supports the idea of the state paying for a party primary. And I'm going, hold on here.
Yeah, okay.
You know, you're complaining about the party, but the reality is the party's doing things the party shouldn't even be doing. Why don't you get on the right side of all of this? And so, you know, it'd be great if you actually piped in and go, you know what? I have to fully agree that the party has no right to be able to take taxpayer money and execute a primary to downselect those who are going to represent them. If they want to do that, they should pay for that themselves. And then they should tell people, if you want to vote for who is going to be the primary, you know, who's going to be playing in the primary, and you want to vote for that, you got to pay for your ballot.
Right.
Bottom line, you're going to, this would be the death of the parties.
I love it.
This would be the death of their control over what's going on. This would literally force a single election and take us all down to, and what may end up happening. And I'm okay with, you know, if you do a down select, a runoff, I'm okay with runoff elections. You take the top two or three, you know, depending on how many people are in the field, to say, you know, could this one person, if you, you know, take the top three, and could this third person with the amount of votes that they got and all of the other, you know, candidates that you throw out that are underneath them, would that have been enough to make them ahead of anybody else?
Right.
So you figure it out that way to determine, okay, because I don't like the top two. I just don't like it. You know, to be arbitrary to say just the last two. I think that it's, if you, let's say you had 50. Let's say you had 50 candidates for governor, and you had probably four or five that were really, you know, kind of neck and neck. But you, if you only took the top two, you completely marginalized the real ability of maybe some of these other people. That if you took the 46, you know, votes that you, and apply to any one of these, or you get it down to 40, then you do another election with the 10. You do it. You have to do it that way. I do not like the party dictating who gets to, you know, represent them by, you know, having these primaries at the taxpayers' expense. Because
I don't either.
There you go.
You know, I've had the same position with my audiences. That why is it that the taxpayers are paying a private club to down select your choices in an election?
Right.
And in fact, you said something interesting, said if they want to participate in this primary, have them pay for their ballot.
Right.
That's awesome.
Right.
I like that idea.
Yeah.
Because essentially the parties tend to be run by paid memberships.
Yeah. See, if you didn't understand, the taxpayers are flipping the bill for supporting the parties.
Correct.
By taxes, because the government is in cahoots with them.
Correct.
You can't see it any other way.
Right.
Because that's why we have, the only reason we have primaries is for the parties to actually have a tighter control to make sure that who goes into the final, you know, the final stages of the beauty contest are the beauties that they want.
Right.
They say, oh, no, it's really to the people. But no, if it was really to the people, we would make all elections local as well. We would keep the money from being able to transition across county lines or from, you know, from rural or urban lines into the city. We need to start drawing the line that no money can go into an election that comes out from outside of the election area.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, we can secure it anyway.
So what do you say to this? I had a discussion about that with someone. I know we're off on a tangent,
yeah,
but I want to touch this one because making elections local would dramatically change so much. Okay, but what do you say to someone who says, "But you know, if I can't support somebody with my dollars, you're limiting my political speech."
Not at all. Not at all. Do you have a right to representation in that area of election?
No.
Then you have no right to influence it. As a matter of fact, we have laws against, you know, foreign influence. And as far as we're concerned, if you don't live in this circle, then you're a foreigner.
Right. Yep.
Right.
So you have a right to your political speech if you're represented there.
Right. So in other words, stay in your area and speak all you want and speak all that you want regarding your representation. But shut up unless you're the only thing a person could get away with is regarding the Constitution. In other words, it's not about the party. It's not about an agenda. But when you say, well, this person does not seem like a constitutional because of this, 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 and this. And, you know, as a matter of fact, I would advocate that we test all of these people on the Constitution, and then let's vote for the person that tests the best.
Sure.
I think we would be far better off if we had those types of standards.
Woohoo. Okay.
Okay.
That's right. Okay. We have, I think we're back from the tangent now. Right.
Right. And we're 13 minutes left. Go ahead. Back into.
Okay. So we're Mr. Davey, and we just got finished. We're in Pennsylvania, right? Is that where we are? In Pennsylvania, their paper money was not a tender.
So, okay. Yeah. Go ahead. I see where you're at.
Okay.
Yep.
In Pennsylvania, their paper money was not a tender in discharge of private contracts. In South Carolina, their bills became eventually a tender. And in Rhode Island, New York, New Jersey, and North Carolina, the paper money was made a legal tender in all cases whatsoever. The other states were sensible that the destruction of the circulating paper would be a violation of the rights of private property, and that such a measure would render the accession of those states to the system absolutely impracticable. The injustice and pernicious tendency of this disgraceful policy were viewed with great indignation by the states which adhered to the principles of justice. In Rhode Island, the paper money had depreciated to 8-for-1 and 100% with us. Okay, and 100% with us. He's got periods in the wrong place.
Right, uh-huh.
The people of Massachusetts and Connecticut had been great sufferers by the dishonesty of Rhode Island. And similar complaints existed against that state, this state. This clause became, in some measure, a preliminary with the gentleman who represented the other states. Quote, you have, end quote, said they, quote, by your iniquitous laws and paper emissions, shamefully defrauded our citizens. The Confederation prevented our compelling you to do them justice, but before we confederate with you again, you must not only agree to be honest, but put it out of your power to be otherwise. Sir, a member from Rhode Island itself could not have set his face against such language. The clause was, I believe, unanimously assented to. It was only a future aspect and can by no means have a retrospective operation. And I trust the principles upon which the convention proceeded will meet with approbation of every honest man. But Rhode Island was really a pariah.
Yeah, it really was. And there was a reason for that, though. I mean, they deserved what they got. I mean, mm-hmm. What happens if all of a sudden you cheat people? I mean, if you're a car dealership and you cheat people and you sell them lemons and you turn your back on them and all of that, mm-hmm. You know, what happens to a business like that?
Oh, your reputation deserves to be well known.
Absolutely. And so you have a hard time doing business.
Right.
And so what ends up happening is, you know, nobody wants to do business with you anymore. Mm-hmm. Come on.
Right.
I mean, can you blame the way things went down? No, you can't. I mean, it's the nature of what needed to happen. And so look at Rhode Island today.
Right.
I mean, Rhode Island happens to be a far left-leaning and highly progressive institution. I mean, it's lost its concept. I'm not sure if it ever had a concept of liberty. I mean, right? I mean, how has it led? It claimed to be on the high ground every step of the way, and every time I look at it in the point of history, it seems to be in the valley.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you.
Anyway.
I don't know the answer to that right now, but let's see. We've got a little time for...
Yes, we have, let me see, 8 minutes, 9 minutes, a little less than 9 minutes.
So are we in the same place as Mr. Cabarrus?
Yeah, ex post facto. Yes, ex post
facto. Money.
Okay. This is good stuff, folks.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I contend that the clause which prohibits the states from emitting bills of credit will not affect our present paper money. The clause has no retrospective view. This constitution declares in the most positive terms that no ex post facto law shall be passed by the general government. Were this clause to operate retrospectively, it would clearly be ex post facto and repugnant to the express provision of the constitution. How then, in the name of God, can the constitution take our paper money away? If we have contracted for a sum of money, we ought to pay according to the nature of our contract. Every honest man will pay in specie who engaged to pay it. But if we have contracted for a sum of paper money, it must be clear to every man in this committee that we shall pay in paper money. This is a constitution for the future government of the United States. It does not look back. Every gentleman must be satisfied on the least reflection that a paper money will not be destroyed. To say that it will be destroyed is a popular argument, but not founded in fact, in my opinion. I had my doubts, but on consideration, I am satisfied with it. Mr. Bloodworth responds. Mr. Chairman, I beg leave to ask if the payment of sums now due be ex post facto. Will it be an ex post facto law to compel the payment of money now due in silver coin? If suit be brought in the federal court against one of our citizens for a sum of money, will paper money be received to satisfy the judgment? I inquire for information. My mind is not yet satisfied. It has been said that we are to send our own gentlemen to represent us, and that there is not the least doubt they will put the construction on it, which will be most agreeable to the people they represent. But it behooves us to consider whether they can do so if they would, when they mix with the body of the Congress. The northern states are much more populous than the southern ones. To the north of the Susquehanna are 36 representatives, and to the south of it only 29. They will always outvote us. Sir, we ought to be particular in adopting a constitution which may destroy our currency. When it is to be the supreme law of the land and prohibits the emission of paper money, I am not, for my part, for giving an indefinite power. Gentlemen of the best abilities differ in the construction of the Constitution. The members of Congress will differ too. Human nature is fallible. I am not for throwing ourselves out of the Union, but we ought to be cautious by proposing amendments. The majority in several great adopting states was very trifling. Several of them have proposed amendments, but not in the mode most satisfactory to my mind. I hope this convention never will adopt it till amendments are actually obtained.
So one of the things he points out here is he talks about how the North already is outpeopling them and how they see the North growing with more people due to the nature of their government or due to the nature of their paradigm. In other words, you can clearly see that they're aware that the South is going to be on the losing end regarding slavery and protecting themselves.
They're seeing this early.
So in other words, we read in Pennsylvania, we read in Massachusetts, we read in a few of the states of the North where it was brought up that this Constitution would eventually eradicate slavery. Because they were talking about this in the North, how, you know, the fact that they're keeping this, what, this is a dread, this is a scourge. And they're saying, contrary, as Wilson stated, I see this as the advantage of actually getting rid of this. Now we see it in the South where there is an acknowledgement right here that the way politics are, that the North would prevail. And what proves this is the necessity of the Missouri Compromise. How they had to resort to political theatrics and violating the Constitution to sustain slavery. And at that point, there's no doubt in my mind, George Mason's prophecy was basically on its path of being fulfilled, that God would punish these states and these nations for actually doing what they did.
Mason's prophecy?
Yeah, so George Mason basically said because nations and states cannot be punished in heaven, this nation and these states will be punished for maintaining slavery. God gave them the solution. He said that before the compromise occurred. He said that when they said, okay, we're going to allow slavery. And this is what, and then they started battling over what they were going to do. The three-fifths rule, the ending of the slave trade, and the returning of slaves and so forth. But eventually, it was going to get to a point where the northern states would be in a political position, and new states coming into the Union, which couldn't be slaved. They didn't know this, but right after this Constitutional Convention convened, the Northwest Ordinance was ratified by Continental Congress, which abolished slavery going into any new state.
Okay.
And in August of 1789, during Congress, they started bringing in all of these different laws, and the Northwest Ordinance is one of those that they used as a guideline, because that Continental Congress had already passed that law, so they integrated that as a guideline for admitting new states into the Union.
Right.
Okay, so anyway, my point is that, you know, the evidence is very, very clear. Mm-hmm. That what, you know, what we see with this Constitution, and they're telling us, you know, they're telling us so. In other words, when we hear people say that this Constitution was an oppressive Constitution, that is an idiot that is basing their knowledge on somebody who has bent the truth. There is nothing founded in truth stating that this Constitution was a racist, oppressive Constitution. Zero evidence. We've read through this, and I've searched on the words of slavery and so forth, and you can do the same thing. Folks, I ask you to do the same thing. You are not going to find the evidence that these historical, or I should say these revisionists of history, are out there trying to peddle. And I know this is, you know, something that you're concerned with. There's a lot of people out there that, you know, our history has been rewritten, and it has nothing to do with the truth. So, right. This is why it's so important to have these clear snapshots. Like I told you, the snapshot of Mount Everest. I mean, there is litter in the street. There is some pollution in the air. But Mount Everest is a mighty mountain, and that image, that picture, clearly portrays that. Just because there's a little bit of smoke, there's a little bit of, you know, but after a good rain, maybe that smoke's not in the air. During a rainfall, you can't even see if the mountain's there because it's a picture of clouds.
Right.
But the reality is the reality that mountain is there, and people will be people. People will be dirty. People will make a mess. And artists will do everything they can to change the picture to give you the image that they want you to have. And we have to stop allowing artists to actually use subjectivity in the way they want to produce. This is why I tell you folks all the time, do not take my word for it. Read these things. 5 seconds. We've literally ran out of time. Paul, thank you again for this week.
Thanks, GR.
No, thank you. I really appreciate it. I couldn't do it without you. And as a matter of fact, folks, I can't do this without you and your support. I appreciate everything. I truly do. And I don't say that enough. So as I always say, the ratification debates are our greatest treasure, and I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic with you, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.